Blog Talk Radio.
Slow down, touch your life. Don't you know there's friends to be found? Lift your eyes and see the world.
Welcome to the Sunbury Press Show. I'm Tori Gates, author of Searching for Roy Buchanan. Sunbury Press publishes print and electronic books under 10 different imprints in a variety of categories sold worldwide wherever you can find books. This program is the latest in a series on the coronavirus pandemic in conjunction with the recent release, After the Pandemic, Visions of Life Post-COVID-19. Today's show focuses on the economic and environmental impacts of COVID-19. Three authors who contributed pieces to this work join me today. First is Brooke Lenker, Executive Director of the Frack Tracker Alliance, and he's also author of The Restorers, a Riley Waters expedition on Year of the Book Press, which was released in 2019. His contribution is Conservation in the Midst. Welcome, Brooke.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Also joining us is Simon Landry, a native of Montreal, Quebec. He is a teacher of high school mathematics, and he is author of the Milford Press release, Chestnut Street. His contribution to the book is On the Economic Front. Welcome, Simon.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And our third guest is the founder of Sunbury Press Books, Lawrence Knorr, author of numerous books on art, history, baseball, and other subjects. Lawrence conceived of the new collection, and he contributed the various economic impacts of COVID-19. We speak again, Lawrence.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Tori.
All right, well, first, let us begin with each of you, where you are currently, and how are affairs being handled around your local area? Brooke, let's start with you.
Yeah, Tori. I'm based in Camp Hill, Central Pennsylvania, so I believe we're moving to a code yellow very soon, and so things will be liberalized. There'll be a little bit more moving around allowed, and you know, it's interesting. I was just noting yesterday. I was out myself, and you know, it seems like life is slowly unfurling, both in the springtime context, but also very much, you know, people's activities. And I mean, it was a Friday afternoon, granted, but things seemed almost normal. There was a lot of traffic. There were a lot of people moving around. And so I think it's, you know, it's a sign of what's to come. We're going to try to get back to some normalcy, I assume. But obviously, we know there's still great risk. And I guess time will tell how we're all doing in terms of our practices. But you know, it is encouraging. Even yesterday, I was out helping at a safe distance do a tree planting project with the Yellow Breeches Watershed Association, and it was neat to see the interest in that and people walking by and commenting on it. And so I still remain hopeful and about, you know, our connections to nature, and hopefully I can talk a little bit about that this morning.
Definitely. Well, I'm right across the river from you. I'm in Harrisburg, so I'm seeing a lot of the same things. And I can just very basically say, because I am an essential worker, so I have to travel about during the week anyway. And it has slowly come back. There's a little bit of confidence returning, as you say, but you also make a good point, is there's some changes that really have to come about, and whether or not we adapt to them is something that we're going to need to see. Simon, you and I spoke just before we went on about Montreal. Your city is being hit pretty hard. Please explain a little bit.
Well, basically, because spring break in Quebec was at the first week of March, there was a lot of travelers that came back from, you know, Europe and Asia and the Caribbean, and we were hit pretty hard. And when you compare Montreal to the rest of Canada and the U.S., we're not doing so good. The rest of the province is doing great. The schools are opening slowly. Businesses are starting up again. But Montreal is still in a crisis. Most businesses are still closed. Schools are going to remain closed until September for everyone, whereas outside of Montreal, a elementary schools are opening up again. So, you know, the problem is in Montreal per se, because outside of the city, things are slowly getting back to normal. In the city itself, you know, it's the curve is slowly, very slowly starting to come down. So hopefully within a month or two, things will get back to some sense of normalcy. But for now, we're still in the peak of the infection curve here in Montreal.
And you gave me something that was a rather chilling detail about the older population is being hit very, very hard.
Yes, most of the older population in the retirement centers are being hit because, you know, since there was a lot of travel at the first week of March, a lot of you know, parents and grandkids starting visiting their grandparents in the old folks home, and we didn't know that even if you were asymptomatic, you could still, you know, spread the disease. So, you know, those centers were hit very, very hard, and most of the deaths in Montreal are in those homes. But, you know, we've had the army come in and help because there's a lot of, there's not enough staff to take care of everybody that's sick in these homes. So even the army's come in to help, you know, just help give meals and wash, you know, residents and, you know, just give basic services because they're hit so hard that there's not enough hands on the deck to, you know, to keep our head above water. So right now we're hit pretty hard, but like I said, you know, hopefully it's starting to come down for the past few days. So hopefully the worst is over.
Okay. And Lawrence, how about you? You are out to the west of both Brooke and myself, if I'm correct.
Yeah, it's kind of surreal out here, Tori. We live on a farm that's been here since the Revolution, and in the Boiling Springs area, which the zip code 17007, according to the stats I've seen, I don't think we've had any cases. So we're a little island just a little further west in Cumberland County, and really life around here has been the same as it has always been. It's been pretty quiet. It's a fairly rural area, and you don't notice anything until you go to the grocery store. So drive a few miles, go towards Carlisle, Mechanicsburg, you know, that area, and then you start to see the masks. Then you start to see the, you know, for a while we were seeing stockouts in the store. So my first indication, besides turning on the news, was, you know, going to the store and seeing the economic impacts that we're going to talk about, but, you know, being out of certain things and, you know, people panic buying and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So we're kind of lucky here. We're very grateful that in our immediate area, it has not been so prevalent, but I know all around us it's rampant.
All right. Well, let us get into these pieces that have been composed for the book. I'm going to start with you, Brooke. You mentioned this earlier. You begin your piece with evidence which I don't think anybody can say is untrue. You've talked about a connection to the outdoors we may have lost, and I felt that myself over the years. I grew up in rural Vermont, and I remember that. And tell us a little bit from your perspective on what is lost, and is it possible now we might be able to have a chance of getting it back?
Sure. Well, I think it probably goes without saying that one of the big drivers of sort of nature disconnect is likely technology, in terms of, you know, our lots of screen time and other things that take us away from enjoying the outdoors and practicing conservation. And certainly, too, there are, you know, other factors, but young people in particular have been struck by what this what an author named Richard Louv talks about as nature deficit disorder. And, and Louv well documents the changes in the amount of time young people spend outside. And, you know, and again, there's all sorts of factors that affect that. I mean, even just the fear of, the fear for your children's safety, changes in the way schools allot time for field trips and experiences in nature, you know, and the list goes on. And so that's a real thing. And there's a lot of concern about that, because it's not just about the health and wellness aspects of you know, exercising in the outdoors, but it's a fear that we may sort of lose our concern about the state of nature, the state of our planet. And if you don't have that bond, that connection to what's around you, you may not care. And we know that there are a lot of major stressors, to say the least, affecting, you know, planet Earth. So that's, you know, that's sort of a known. And I guess my contention is, or my hope at least, is that because we've slowed down during this crisis, at least we have to date to some extent, or to a large extent, actually, and that we've realized we can go without less, or with less, rather. We can, you know, we certainly have been using less energy, less fossil fuels. Then maybe that will stick. I guess that's the, you know, the underlying premise, that some of this will stick with us. And even if when things slowly normalize, that a relic of this will stay with us. So maybe we'll think differently about, you know, what we're doing around our homes. We'll make time to continue to explore the outdoors. We'll invest in, you know, in conservation, whether that's donations to organizations fighting to protect our environment, or supporting, you know, legislation that helps our state parks, or, you know, our national parks, whatever that may be. And I hope too that it overflows to how we think about energy. You know, whether we, you know, get a more fuel efficient car or get an electric car. I talk a little bit about that in my chapter, or allude to that. I think I am cautiously hopeful that those practices will prevail at some level. I mean, there's a lot that goes into that, a lot of variables, but I'll stand by that. I hope that's what we see.
Well, that's another thing too, habits. We have a lot of, you know, human nature is habits, and you often hear about when someone is dealing with something such as addiction, you substitute a positive habit for a negative one. The positive habit might be, you know, that reconnection, that sort of thing.
Yeah, it's I certainly hope so. And it's interesting, just, you know, I'm making a lot of anecdotal observations, and even my own family, because we're spending a lot more time here at home, I'm observing, and my grown kids are observing, and my wife's observing, just the nature around us. And it's really interesting to see, you know, my kids getting out, you know, the bird book and keying out what we're seeing in our backyards. It's interesting to know too, that I'm seeing, for example, bird species that I've never seen here before. And I don't know how much of that I attest to never having spent so much time looking out the window at my home perhaps some of the sightings could have to do with the slightly cleaner air we're experiencing right now. Maybe a little bit more quiet because of, you know, the roads aren't quite as busy, et cetera. But seeing all kinds of interesting bird life, and I'm hearing a little from other folks a little bit of the same.
Okay.
So,
we'll see what happens. We will definitely see. I'd like to go to Simon. Your first observation in your piece is a prediction of sorts that our global economy has rather maxed itself out. And you noted the current economic models aren't geared for the long term. Give us an idea of what direction you think we might be facing.
Well, we've already started to notice that people are, looking into buying local more and more, because we've seen, as Lawrence said, in the supermarkets, some items have been, you know, out of stock for a while because they've been produced overseas, and the countries that produce those goods have been hit pretty hard, and their manufacturers are not open, and you know, so I think we've hit, you know, the top of our capacity of buying things that are made overseas. The market has hit its peak, and you know, as I said in my piece, the market dictates right now and for the past few years that, you know, profit should be maximized at all costs. So as I said, you know, if you want to buy a phone and the company that sells you that phone wants to sell it to you for, say, $800, well, they're going to try to make it for the cheapest possible price to maximize their profit. The problem with that, you don't create jobs that way, because, as I said in my piece, if you have a choice between buying a T-shirt for $10 that was made in the U.S. and a one that would that costs $6 that was made in China, most people are going to buy the $6 one and think, well, that's not too bad. I save $4. That's a good choice. But you help the factories overseas take your money, and all the while the people in the American factories are, you know, not working. So you create an inequity of some sort, whereas you need goods to live, but you also need to help local productions. And if you keep, if as a company you keep to, you try to keep the profit at a maximum instead of trying to keep the community healthy, it's not going to survive. And as I said in my piece, and I talked to Lawrence about it, you have to remember a time, especially in the U.S., but most of North America, where everything was pretty much manufactured, you know, inside our own borders. You know, you used to make cars and TVs and electronics and clothes. Everything was made locally. And you remember cities that were built around huge manufacturing plants. And for the past couple of decades, those plants have slowly started moving overseas to maximize profit for that company. But the problem is, when you move a factory overseas, the community that was built around that factory, they all stop working. And they stop, you know, earning income. And they stop buying things that was made in another factory in another community, and it's a vicious circle that's pretty hard to break free of now. But I'm starting to see more and more people, you know, here and, you know, friends abroad looking into buying more local products and encouraging things that were made locally. Even though it might be slightly more expensive, you think about, you know, that $2 I spent for something that was made locally that costs more than the one that was made, say, in India. Well, at least I'm helping someone, because it creates work, it creates jobs in another community, and that person is going to earn money and is going to buy a product from another community inside their own borders and so on. So it's not a cycle that's going to be easy to break free of right now, but I think slowly we're moving towards that direction where we see that we've become too dependent on foreign economies to produce the goods we need to, you know, I don't want to say survive, but almost survive, because some things we can't do without. I'm thinking about electronic cell phones. Nowadays, people only need computers and cell phones, and those things are made overseas, and now, you know, we're dependent on those countries. So I think we have to look into, you know, encouraging local factories, local products, you know, made in USA, made in Canada, and you know, the trade organizations have to, you know, I'm looking for the word, you know, geographically closer. Like U.S. and Canada and Mexico should be a nice trade organization, because, you know, we share borders. But, you know, starting to do trade deals with foreign nations that are thousands of miles away, it might be good for the market, might be good for a company's profit, but it's not good for the people inside that country.
Well, that brings me to a question for Lawrence. Now, in your piece, you looked at the areas where economic impact is going to be felt, and it seems like it's going to be felt, as Simon was saying, business-wise, in real estate. Any of us who own property or have a connection for home or work, we're going to see changes. Tell us a little about what you think the impacts are going to be like, Lawrence. What do you think is coming?
Well, yeah, I know my article was sort of a survey of the economy. And, you know, I'll just extend a little bit what Simon was saying first, and that is, you know, what we're talking about here is in the past, you know, free trade was based on the concept of absolute or comparative advantage, meaning the lowest cost producer, the one who can make it cheapest, gets the business. And when we globalize that, that means production shifts offshore and away from us. You know, and then you have the concept of economies of scale, which is that as it gets bigger and bigger, it gets less expensive to produce each unit. So that's why we have such cheap products these days, and they're made all over the place, a lot of them in China. So, you know, we have this consumer culture of these cheap goods that you can buy everywhere, and they're all manufactured overseas. You know, I argue that that's not really a sustainable approach, and that the model for comparative advantage or absolute advantage actually misses some key elements, which are all about risk to the society. So when you take into account the total cost of all this exchange, which is the risk of a virus coming from overseas, or the risk of lack of security in the local economy, so you don't have local manufacturing, you don't have a local food supply chain, those things get really scary. And I think this COVID event has exposed a lot of that, because we've seen shortages and we've heard of, you know, about a lot of stress in some areas. We couldn't get PPE as quickly as we wanted. We found out there were things that we just don't make here. And that's pretty amazing when you consider the largest economy in the world isn't making some things, you know, in a reasonable distance from home. So I saw something the other day where the typical meat production, the food travels well over 1,000 miles on its way onto your plate. And so local production would certainly have a lot of merits.
Simon, bring you back in here. You go into detail about the relationship with China, whose economy, you know, is very much entwined with ours. You call for a breaking off of sorts. Maybe that sort of piggybacks on what Lawrence is saying. Can we accomplish something like that? It would seem monumental on the face of it.
Well, it is monumental, and I don't think you can do it overnight. I think it's something that we can gradually move towards for the next few years, few decades or so. But, you know, it is something I think we need to look into, because, as Lawrence said, we've become dependent on these economies for our goods. And Lawrence talked about, you know, PPEs, for protection equipment for the medical staff. And there was actually an article in Global News, I think it was at the end of April, where a reporter uncovered that, you know, China asked their Chinese citizens overseas to buy as much PPE as possible and send it back to China, because they couldn't even manufacture their own PPE. They were hit so hard. So, you know, and then you turn around and the U.S. they didn't have any PPE available, and they were dependent on China to manufacture them. So I think we need to break off on that model. And yes, I think, you know, with everything we've uncovered so far about their handling of the pandemic and the way the economies are, I don't want to say unbalanced, but so far the trade balance is not in our favor. So I think, yes, we need to start to break off from these from the Chinese government. And I want to be careful, because we're talking about the Chinese government. We're not talking about Chinese people. And people need to be careful about, you know, the way they approach things, because Chinese people are not to blame. The Chinese government is to blame. And yes, we need to move. As I said in my piece, maybe the first thing we should do is erase the debt toward China, because this pandemic is going to cost trillions of dollars, and it's clearly China's fault. So the first thing I think the U.S. and most Western countries should do is default on their debt towards China, because it doesn't seem fair to me that we would have to pay as a result of this pandemic and still keep a debt towards the country that was responsible for it. But yeah, we need to start, like I said, to bring, you know, manufacturing back to inside our own borders, as we used to do, as, you know, people are of a certain age remember after the Second World War, you know, most products were made locally. And as Darwin said, the only reason we started outsourcing those manufacturing plants was to make it the cheapest possible and make and maximize profits. And we've seen the results of that now. So I think it might be a good idea to start looking about, looking into, you know, bringing those manufacturing abilities back inside our own borders. Mm-hmm. But it's not going to be easy, and it's going to take some time. And of course, as I said in my piece, it all comes down to the consumer. If the consumer keeps buying things at the cheapest possible price instead of buying things based on, you know, quality and where it's coming from, maybe the change can bring about. But if we keep looking for the cheapest possible deal, nothing's going to change.
Okay.
Yeah, Terry, this is a question. Just interject real quick.
Please do.
Yeah, I just also wanted to mention as sort of a hook for Brooke is not only have we offshored to the cheapest production, but we've offshored our pollution, because all this manufacturing happens overseas where there aren't the regulations that we have here. So now it's no longer in our backyard, but it's over in China, and but it's polluting worse than ever.
That is a question I have. Yeah, no, well, that's fine, because that is something I wanted to ask Brooke about. You pointed to a study about emissions and how they've drastically increased, especially in parts of China. Where does fundamental need to change begin in this time when it comes to this sort of thing?
Wow. Yeah. I mean, I think I allude to air pollution in a couple different ways in my chapter, both from the standpoint of how severe pollution is in certain places. And I use the example of Wuhan, China, because you could see it, you know, on satellite images very clearly. And I think even beyond the COVID period, we've seen images of the just wretched pollution in not just in China, but in India and in other places. And you know, that's clearly in part from what Lawrence referenced. I mean, it's just substandard pollution controls. But I mean, we have serious air pollution in this country too. And we just, I mean, it's not thankfully on the, to the level of degradation that we see other places, but we have serious problems with fine particulate matter, ground level ozone, and other pollutants. And so, you know, we know that even small improvements in air quality can increase longevity, you know, and we know that, and sort of conversely, we know that high levels of air pollution, you know, really take a toll on people with pre-existing conditions and asthma, for example. It was really interesting, too. I mentioned this in the piece, how researchers have found this connection between areas with higher air pollution and the transmittance of COVID-19. So there's, well, two things. One, the susceptibility to it, because of the poor air quality and the way it stresses people's respiratory systems, but also actually the actual transmission of COVID-19. So it's sort of a double whammy, if you think of it that way, that just to underscore that this virus can actually ride particulate matter, basically. So studies have found that as well. And interestingly, even since I wrote the chapter, there's been a whole slew of new air quality studies coming out. So I guess back to your original question is, I think, you know, given that we've also seen with this, as the crisis has caused these lockdowns, we've seen the clearing of the air. We've seen, and not just the air. I mean, we've seen it. You probably saw images of, I guess it was in Venice, of the clear water in the canals, because society slowed down. We stopped consuming as much. We stopped polluting as much. Air, water, you know, clearing of the land, et cetera. And that paid that paid quick dividends in terms of nature showing nature's resiliency. I mean, we clearly saw that, you know, wildlife came out and the water cleared and all these different things. So it underscores that if we sort of ratchet down on pollution and think about consumption and getting back to some of the things that Simon and Lawrence said about sustainability, that we can improve the quality of life, because our quality of life isn't just measured by, you know, the things we have. It's, I mean, in terms of possessions, it's measured too in the ability to live and thrive and breathe clean air and, you know, and enjoy greenery and the outdoors. So I do think, you know, we've seen point blank the relationship between our practices and pollution and how just changing some things, kind of monkeying with the system, how we can see at least these short-term benefits. Now, right. You know, things like climate change are unraveling at a, an accelerating pace, but still it's something that's you know, slow moving, generally speaking. And you know, time will tell how even how the short-term changes, but more importantly long-term changes, can slow that. But but nonetheless, I think these changes have been observable. And that too, I think, will affect our, I would hope, our decision making going forward. And then just a final point I'd like to make, you know, and this is where things get pretty complex. But obviously, we've seen with our lessening consumption, we've seen that includes gasoline, and we've seen price collapses in the oil market. And companies are really hemorrhaging. And so it will be interesting to see how the oil industry and the natural gas industry weather this storm for them. But it's also then an opportunity in a variety of ways to accelerate this transition. When I say the transition, meaning the transition to renewable energy. Because, I mean, yeah, there's a double tension. With low gas prices, we may be tempted to, you know, keep driving a larger vehicle, and because we're not as worried about the price of gas. But there's also this sort of more this larger economic inertia that if the one industry sort of crashing, how can the other industries like renewables take advantage of that? So it'll be really interesting to see how we might prevail in accelerating the renewable energy transition as a result of the various dynamics that I just mentioned.
Well, this question is for Lawrence, but Simon and Brooke jump in on this as well. The way we do business is already changing, and we've talked about this a little bit before. We are looking as an industrialized – we have two industrialized nations we're talking about here ourselves. We're looking at potential downsizing of the economy. And where do you think we're going to need to see downsizing? Where do you think that kind of change is going to be initiated?
Wow. Well, first of all, as you know, our whole American economy, the whole West, the free market economy is based on growth. Growth in productivity, growth in consumer consumption, growth in population. So yeah, when you start to talk about downsizing, that runs completely counter to the structure of our whole system. And so at a high level, the main concern I have is about anytime you talk about downsizing, you're talking about what could trigger a deflationary cycle, which is like a death spiral in finance, where you're waiting for things to be cheaper and cheaper and you're not spending your money. That was what happened during the Great Depression and was the main reason why we had the collapse that we did. It was a lack of demand. So you got to be very careful that when you're trying to get through this, that you don't collapse demand by downsizing too much or by changing habits too quickly, because the whole system can collapse. And you can see what happens when the system starts to collapse. You get unintended consequences. So it's important that whatever transition we're going to go through, that we manage it to do it gradually. And it is clear that we need to onshore more rather than offshore so much. We need to be more sustainable onshore. Yes, we could probably do with a little less in our homes. We could probably eat a little bit less food. We could be outside more than we are. All those things are good. But, you know, when you get to the energy piece and you talk about downsizing, let's say oil, we just saw the really scary situation where it collapsed so much that you had to pay to give away your oil. People didn't want to buy it for a while because there wasn't storage capacity. And so when you get to that point where gasoline has a negative price, essentially, that's a pretty bizarre state to be in, obviously not normal.
And that's the kind of thing that can touch off a panic.
Yeah. And just to note with the energy thing, I studied this a while back and gave a talk during the peak oil phase in the early 2000s before fracking, and before Brooke got all upset about fracking, the United States was declining in its ability. Before we were energy independent, we were at this point of peak oil where we were terrified. I remember talking about, you know, our structure and our economy is oil-based. You know, our shopping malls, our highways, our cars, everything. There's such a multi-trillion-dollar investment in that, and that we were about to reach a peak where we wouldn't have that energy cheap. You know, it wouldn't be as cheap as it was anymore. Lo and behold, we go through this revolution. Now oil's cheap. The unfortunate thing with energy is there's no quick, easy substitute. The amount of power that you get and the independence that you get with petroleum products. And it's going to take some time for us to innovate our way through that. But, Tori, I see a lot of areas where there could be downsizing. I'm very concerned about the service sector, especially about restaurants. I think there's going to be a collapse in the whole restaurant industry. We're already seeing brick-and-mortar retail collapsing, companies declaring bankruptcy. You're going to have empty malls. Where malls were dying slow, malls will be done. Where you have,
well, we just heard that JCPenney has filed for bankruptcy. There's another one.
Yeah, and so really concerned about, you know, one thing we like to do is go out to eat. I'm worried that that's not going to be easily done in the new era. I mean, there's going to be new concerns about transmitting viruses in these businesses. We'll see what kind of regulations come along, too, from state and local governments about that. That's going to change dramatically. Education is something that, you know, we're all concerned about how we're going to execute that. You know, it just doesn't seem to work as well online as it does in person. So I let the other guys talk.
Yes, Simon, let's bring you in again.
Yeah, well, I'm going to touch on what Lawrence talked about a few minutes ago. Like you said, you know, I think there's going to be some downsizing, but two things we need to remember is the first thing, you know, we talked about the Great Depression. We recovered from it eventually. It wasn't easy. It took a while, but you know, the old saying, life finds a way. But it will be hard for the next few years, maybe the next few decades. But you know, the economy will shift. The economy will transform and will find a way to be sustainable again. But yes, we need to look at, you know, ourselves as consumers about our buying habits. Lawrence said it. We talked about it. We might be over-consuming a bit. Just look, the easiest example to look about is, you know, smartphones. Most people change their phones once a year, even sometimes twice a year. And you need to ask yourself, do you really need to change your phone that often? You know, just to get a sharper camera, just a few apps that you didn't need to before. I mean, you need to think about, okay, can I buy something that was made locally? Might cost a little more, so maybe I'll change it every 2 years instead of changing it every single year. So that kind of transformation will take place, I think, over the next few years, because like we said, it's not the current model is not sustainable, and the current model is driven by maximum profit at all cost, and the profit is not for the workers, it is for the investors. And when a company decides to outsource its production overseas, it's not to make the consumer happy, it's not to make its employees happy, it's to make its investors happy so that they make maximum profit and that money returns to the investors. And I think we've seen, you know, the result of that current economic model that we've been in for the past few decades. So I think that shift is going to take place. And yes, I know as a teacher myself, I think teaching will be transformed even as we speak right now. You know, every schools are closed over here and they will be until September, but we need to, we're scrambling right now to find a way to teach to our kids because even though the schools are closed, the school year is not over and we're trying to figure out ways to teach, you know, remotely to our students and everybody's trying different things and everybody's scrambling. It's not easy, but I think even that will be transformed. Maybe classrooms will be smaller, maybe even schools will be small because even I remember when my wife used to work in the U.S. just visiting her in Philadelphia, the size of the school are like, you know, small cities. And it was mind-boggling to me to see, a school that size to me was unimaginable.
Mm-hmm.
So even
well,
that will be looked into. Yeah.
Sorry to interrupt. Please finish your thought.
No, I'm finished. Thanks.
Okay. Brooke, in the time we have, you get the last word.
Hey. Well, I guess I just wanted to expand on something that has been a theme in the conversation about bringing our economies home, you know, more local reliance. And I think an interesting way, and this is something encouraging and in the face of all this consternation, is that, you know, people are gardening again and, mm-hmm. Raising vegetables. And I had a little panic when I couldn't find any seeds. I'm a pretty avid gardener, and I take it for granted that I can just go find the seeds in the spring that I need. And not this year. they were the shelves were bare. So, but the upside of that is that people are, kind of reconnecting to the land. And, I totally hear what, and agree with what Lawrence was saying. It's frightening to think about our restaurants, but at least, when we think about food, that we know folks are interested in growing it themselves, having access to fresh produce, at least part of the year. And, anyway, and I think that's too obviously related to this sort of back to nature reconnection with, you know, the living earth that is really important. I mean, it's tied into all these other things very much so. But yeah, I just think it's really interesting to see this victory garden craze again. It's wonderful.
Well, we're going to have to leave it right there. Gentlemen, thank you all for this discussion. We could have gone on all day, but I really appreciate it, all of you.
Thank you.
Thanks, sir.
Our guests have been Brooke Linker, Simon Landry, and Lawrence Knorr, all of whom have offered their views in After the Pandemic, Visions of Life Post-COVID-19, available at Sunbury Press Books, as well as Amazon and other online sellers. A programming note, the next program in our series, COVID-19 Impacts on Education, follows here at 11 a.m. Eastern Time, so just a little over an hour from now, right here. I'm Tory Gates, your host. Thank you for listening. This is the BookSpeak Network.